We're on page 15 of the notes, and this morning I'm going to attempt to cover the period of time from 1945 to the present. We ended last night with the production of the Constitution of the Church, the publication of the Constitution of the Church in a single volume, 1945, and now what happened after that. And the first thing that I want to talk about in that period is the Christian Amendment movement. I commented last night on developments in the National Reform Association, and after the 1920s, the National Reform Association was no longer actively lobbying for a Christian amendment to the Constitution. Its attention had been diverted to other issues, usually moral, social issues like temperance, lobbying against laws permitting gambling, trying to preserve laws that protected the Sabbath, a variety of issues like that, but no longer aggressively or actively seeking a Christian amendment. So the church was still interested in that issue and found other ways to do it. The initial thing that was done was to make use of the Witness Committee of Synod. That was a committee that had been appointed to promote the knowledge and commitment to the distinctive principles of the RP Church. And the Witness Committee in the 1940s employed three ministers of the church to seeking to inform people and gain support for a Christian amendment. And I list the three there: A.J. McFarland, that's Bob's dad, G.M. Robb, who was a pastor of Kansas City congregation in the 1950s, and Sam Boyle, Bill's dad. Sam home from the mission field because of the Second World War. And so those three, and that was a significant commitment on the part of the church to have three ministers dedicating their time to promoting a Christian amendment to the Constitution and the ideal of Christian civil government. Then in 1948, the Synod decided to organize a specific group to carry on this work, and it was called the Christian Amendment Movement. Promoted and sponsored by our church, but intended to be broader in its constituency than just the RP Church, as had been true of the National Reform Association. And the that movement published, I think I'm wrong in what I put down here now that I look at it, I'm sorry. The National Reform Association published The Christian Statesman, continued to do that. The magazine published by Christian Amendment Movement was called The Christian Patriot. The Christian Patriot, so you can make that correction. And one of the things that they did was to promote radio programs, develop and promote radio programs that that's sought to promote the Christian amendment to the Constitution. A.J. McFarland was the executive secretary. He did the work pretty much by himself with the help of Mildred Boyd, that some of you will remember, who was the secretary in the office. And a lot of what Dr. McFarland did was to travel around from town to town where there were small radio stations, and often those radio stations were seeking to fill up their airtime and were open to having ready-made programs. And so I think the way out was at one point on more than 1,000 radio stations around the country. A.J. McFarland persuaded an author by the name of Eugenia Price to write the scripts for the programs, which it's unusual, I would say. She was not a part of a Reformed church, but she was persuaded to use her skills in this way. She had done radio programs for the Pacific Garden Mission, and you may have from time to time have heard those programs. This was a new effort then to seek a Christian amendment. The high water mark of that effort came when there was actually a hearing before the House Judiciary Committee, perhaps a subcommittee of that group, on the Christian amendment. And a number of our ministers went and gave testimony before that group. The Christian Amendment movement also sought year after year to have legislation introduced into the Congress promoting a secret or seeking a Christian amendment. And one of the sponsors, there was a senator from Kansas who did that year after year. Capper, I believe, was his name. And then a man who became nationally known, John Anderson, who was an evangelical Christian, sponsored the amendment a number of times. Later, John Anderson ran for president, and somebody dug up, you know, they do opposition research, dug up the information about his sponsorship of a Christian amendment. And that was offensive to Jewish groups and to other people. And sad to say, John Anderson backtracked as quickly as he could from that, said, well, I didn't really understand the implications of it, didn't go into it thoroughly. So that was a disappointment. That movement continued until 1975. A.J. McFarland died fairly young when he was in his 60s, and after that there was a time when there were three young men who were appointed to head up the work, but they had a different perspective than the historical perspective of the church. This was in the 70s. They'd been influenced by a movement in Canada called the Toronto Institute, Duyverdian philosophy, that had a Dutch background to it, and it was just a different way of thinking about issues than had been true in the church, and they lost the support of the church. The contributions dried up, and so the committee or the movement. This organization called the CAM ended its existence in 1975. Then I want to talk about the Covenant of 1954. As you will know by now, the church had been committed to the practice of covenanting and had done that in this country in 1871, but not since. And so there was a movement in the church to have another occasion of covenanting. A committee was reported to draw up a covenant, and they reported to the synod in 1950. They proposed a covenant to be taken at the National Conference in 1954. So at Grinnell, Iowa, some of you may have been there, on the Sabbath day of that national conference, there was a covenant service in which there was preaching about the covenant, and then the covenant was read, and people raised their hands and gave their adherence to the covenant, and then went forward to sign the covenant in 1954. Now, unlike the covenant of 1871, adherence to this covenant was not made a part of membership in the church was not put into the questions for membership, nor into the questions for ordination. And my sense is that the result of that was that it has pretty much faded out of the consciousness of the church. I noticed in your library here, there is a published volume that comes from 54, which included all of the messages that were preached in connection with this act of covenanting. And the text of the covenant is there also. It was called the Brief Covenant, and it really had nothing new in it from what was in the Covenant of 1871. It was in a much briefer form. I do want to note one detail that I think is significant. In the introduction to the covenant, is this statement: we believe in and accept the standards of the Reformed Presbyterian Church of North America as being in agreement with and founded upon the Scriptures. That's an echo of the covenant of church membership. And then, in particular, we believe in the Reformed faith, emphasizing the sovereignty of Christ, the Presbyterian form of church government, the New Testament pattern of worship with its exclusive use of the Psalms sung a cappella. So there's a commitment to some distinctives of the church, but my eye was caught by the expression, the Reformed faith. And that's language that was not customarily used in our church in earlier times. It reflects the fact that in the 1950s we had come to have quite active fellowship with other Reformed churches, Orthodox Presbyterian Church, Christian Reformed Church in those days, and the expression the Reformed faith was customary in those circles. And so it's a kind of subtle thing, but I believe that it reflects the fact that we were now more consciously identifying ourselves with churches known for their strong Calvinistic doctrine, the kind of doctrine that is in the Westminster Confession of Faith. So I remember in our debates about distinctives that came in the 1970s, one of the older men in the synod, weary of the motions toward change, said, "I don't care if I never hear the word the Reformed faith again." So he kind of identified that expression with these new currents within the church. And then, because we've focused on political dissent, I just want to mention that it was spoken of again in this covenant. We will continue to advocate the separation of church and state. I pause there to say that's a particularly American expression. It would not have characterized the Scottish or the Irish churches, nor our own church in the early days of its existence, but we had come to the point of embracing the American notion of separation of church and state. We will strive to bring each, that is church and state, to the proper acknowledgement of Christ's sovereignty. We therefore will not avail ourselves of those rights and privileges of citizenship that may tend to neutralize our testimony to the rights and claims of Christ over the nations. And that expression continues the pattern that I've commented on before, that in our documents we assumed that people knew what dissent was. So we would say we're going to continue to dissent, but in our documents we did not spell out what that dissent consisted of. So that's the covenant of 1954. And I mentioned in my home church, covenant of 1871 was framed and it was on the wall of the church. I have not seen the covenant of 1954 displayed in that way. So I think for a younger generation in the church, not much is known about the covenant of 1954. Well, number three, revision of chapters 29 and 30 of the testimony, and connected with that, change with regard to political dissent. Paper was brought to Synod in the 1950s, probably it was actually in 1956, questioning the biblical basis for political dissent, and a committee was appointed to answer that paper. And that committee recommended a review of chapters 29 and 30 that dealt with civil government and political dissent. And it took a while, as you will see, 6 years, but then the revision of chapter 29 was approved in Overture. You may or may not know what Overture means, but when there is a change in the constitution of the church, it is made by a two-thirds majority of Synod voting in favor of the change, and then it is sent down to the sessions for their approval. And the sessions of the church have, in a sense, then veto power. And unless it is approved by a significant majority of the sessions and of the ruling elders voting, the change does not take effect. So it's a way of ensuring that changes do not take place easily and without very careful consideration. So these two chapters were sent down an overture. 29 was sent an overture. Chapter 30, which dealt specifically with dissent, lacked one vote of the two-thirds vote needed in Synod, so it was not sent down. The next year, the same chapter was approved by one vote. So there had been a change somehow of two votes in the meantime, and it was sent down an overture. And the report came back the next year that both of the new chapters had been adopted. Brad.
So these chapters, I was just looking at my current confession here. Do chapters 29 and 30, do they compare? I mean, are they, they're not corresponding necessarily with the chapter numbers of the confession?
No. We'll talk a bit about a revision of the testimony that was completed in 1980, but at this point it's appropriate to say, with very great struggle, chapters 29 and 30 were amended in the 1960s, and so when the committee to revise the testimony did its work, over 10 years from about 1970 to 1980, the decision was made not to take up again the revision of those two chapters. But in the revision of 1980, we did a different thing. Instead of having the testimony being a separate document, now it is placed in parallel with the Westminster Confession, as you know, in parallel columns. And all of that material comes under the Westminster chapter on the civil magistrate. And so there was some rearranging of the paragraphs to match up with what is in the Westminster Confession. There may have been some minor changes in wording, but the substance of the revision approved in 1964 appears in our present testimony. And there's probably more in the right-hand column in the chapter on the civil magistrate than in any other chapter, because this has been such a central issue in the church. You know, you have a sense of that now, divisions in the church over it and so on. Great care was taken to cross the T's and dot the I's in the revision. And so it's quite detailed, and there's a background to all of that.
Isn't it a little ironic this is all taking place during the 60s?
Well, it's not entirely coincidental. And think of the 60s as the time of a lot of upheaval about political things. And as we've said all along, our church, conservative and somewhat isolated, was not untouched by all of those currents. Well, the actual change in political dissent came in 1967, but the revision laid the groundwork for it. By the way, Charles McBurney, who used to be in Olathe, was a chairman of this revision committee at one point. He taught political science at Geneva. Dr. Voss was a member of this committee that revised the chapters. But I want to call your attention to two things that are in our present testimony. Paragraph 28. When the church, by orderly processes in her own courts, determines that the oath of allegiance to a civil government compromises the Christian's loyalty to Christ or involves the Christian in the support of sinful principles of civil government, the church must require her members to refuse such sinful oaths. So it looks to the church to make a decision, a determination as to whether the oath to the Constitution was sinful or not. At the point that this was adopted, that was the judgment of the church, that the oath to the Constitution was a sinful oath. And so when the revision was adopted in 1964, it did not change political dissent. There was a movement in that direction. There were some talk about, say, people in local elections, like for school boards or where it was not a matter of national standing that the members of the church might perhaps run for office. But the basic position was unchanged in 1964. It was changed in 1967 because then there was a report of a committee which came in saying, we can no longer say with confidence that the oath to the Constitution is a sinful oath. Why was that? It was because of what we talked about last night, that for 40 years, members of the church had been taking oaths to the Constitution for loyalty oaths or for naturalization or for service as officers in the military with the explanatory declaration, and that had always been permitted when tried. And on the basis of that, the Synod said, we no longer can declare clearly that the oath to the Constitution is a sinful oath. We've been permitting it for 40 years. And therefore, the line of argument that led to no voting and no holding office was broken by the fact that the church no longer declared that the oath to the Constitution was a sinful oath. And so 1967 marked the end of the requirement of political dissent And if you read the minutes of Synod for that year, you'll find a long list of members of Synod who entered their dissent, their disagreement with that action, but it was a majority action. And the church, unlike in 1833 and 1891, did not divide, even though there were very strong feelings about this. Well, let me give you an opportunity for questions or comments. Joe.
Did the ATs come in to the church then?
Yes. Then, and if you have your chart, I don't have mine handy. 1969, they came in. And their difference from us had been political dissent. And although in our testimony we still held a doctrine of the mediatorial kingship of Christ with which they did not fully agree, on the practical matter of political dissent, we had now come to their position, and so the four congregations remaining came into the RP Church.
I know Phil Pockers was looking for an AP Church when he came into Broomall.
Ah, okay.
Found out they merged into the RPCMA.
I see. Okay. Kevin.
What was the explanatory definition?
Okay, we talked about that last night.
I can get with you offline if you
want. I read it out of the minutes of Synod. It was a declaration approved by the church for people who needed to take the oath, say a loyalty oath for teachers, or that said, in taking this oath of the Constitution, I declare my supreme allegiance to Christ, so that it was not a promise of unquestioned obedience to the government. And that had, when I talked about the oath being used for 40 years, it was with that explanation of the sense in which it was taken.
And does that persist today?
It is still, in terms of our testimony, the recommendation of the church that the explanatory declaration be used. It's a recommendation. It's not a requirement.
When did that change?
67. I'm not remembering clearly. I think it was a part of the action in 1967. That was the practical effect of the changes that were made. So, but I think there is a specific action of Synod, but I don't have it with me, and I don't know specifically the date. But the decision in 1967 was, we don't have grounds to say the oath is sinful, so therefore it would be a matter of testimony to use the explanatory declaration, but not required because the oath was no longer regarded as sinful.
If there is a denomination today that was still, that was similar to the RPCMA but had political dissent, would it be a valid argument for them to say that the RPCMA wouldn't be the spiritual descendants of the Covenanters if they don't have political dissent?
Are you thinking Steelites or folks like that?
Yeah, probably something like that.
Well, all along that's been the Steelites' argument, that they represented the faithful remnant. Remember I began, or you may not remember, with the metaphor, what is it that gives me identity as a person through all the changes that occur in my body and in my mind and in my surroundings through a lifetime? There's something that gives continuity. From that standpoint, it would be fair to argue, I think, that our identity has been in political dissent. That was the distinctive principle from all other bodies, and we no longer have that, so we are different from what the church has been historically. So someone could make that claim, but what would be the what would the consequence of that be? I'm not sure, you know, other than bragging rights, something like that. Mary?
There were members of that Elite group, that little one that you preached to, that were teachers. So what would they have done?
I think by the time they were teachers, a loyalty oath was no longer required. That happened in the sort of the crisis of the First World War, but it didn't continue. We had an elder in San Diego, Marshall Smith, that after we left there lost his job with the county because he would not take an oath of the Constitution. But he made a mistake. He didn't do it in the way the church recommended. What he did was to change the wording of the oath to say country instead of Constitution. And the church had not recommended that, but he in fact lost his job and moved back to Broomall and had to get other work. So that's in the 1960s. Nancy.
Dr. Ross was our pastor when I was growing up in the old Kansas City Church, and he had the young people. I was early junior high, and we went out into the different churches, not just the RP churches, but in the Kansas City area, and gave talks about the Christian Amendment movement.
Mm-hmm.
And I had never understood why we didn't vote until he explained to us that we felt so strongly about God being left out of the Constitution that we were willing to give up one of the most precious gifts or the privileges of voting in order to push this ahead.
Yeah.
So he's really got us young people involved.
Uh-huh. Well, I haven't taken time to go through it. In the report in 1967, and I have it here, you could look at it, the full argument is that really there were seven steps of argument needed to arrive at the conclusion that required political dissent. Seven different premises, you might say. And the crucial premise in that seven-step argument was that the oath to the Constitution is a sinful oath. And so when that crucial premise was changed by the church, then the seven-step argument no longer led to the conclusion of political dissent. So it was... there was a logical argument. The logic is good, I think, but for logic to work, the premises have to be true. And the Synod decided that the crucial premise was no longer something that we could with confidence say was enough to exclude people from membership if they wouldn't embrace it.
Is there a paper? Or, I'm curious. I've not heard that. Seven logical steps. That's very interesting to me.
In 1967, it's the report of the committee to study in depth political dissent and give scripture basis. I don't have a page number here on my photocopy, but you're welcome to look at it. Well, let's turn to some other things. Number four, missions. In 1944, we opened a mission in Appalachia, in Kentucky, centered around Sandy Hook in eastern Kentucky, really in the Appalachians. There were a number of missionaries home from the foreign field who were ready to work, so Lillian McCracken and I think Rose Houston were there. Ray and Jenny Hemphill went, and they lived there. The boys grew up partly in Kentucky there in Appalachia, and it was really pretty primitive. Now, in the same area today, the government has built a big dam, and it's become a kind of a high-end recreation area, so it's not Appalachia anymore in the way it was then. But their work was largely in going to little one-room schoolhouses and teaching Bible there in the schoolhouses. That was allowed. And they did hold worship services. They rented, I believe, a church building and held services. And so that, I don't know when that ended. I think when Hemphill's left, that was pretty much the end of that work in Kentucky. In 1949, Dr. Voss, Sam Boyle, Charles Jow, formed the Reformation Translation Fellowship. And this is a quiet work of the church that has probably been as fruitful as anything that we have undertaken to do. The purpose was to translate solid, Reformed literature into the Chinese language. And it was started in 49 when the missionaries were pretty conscious that soon they would not be able to be in China. And Sam Boyle, I remember him saying, when he left China, he wanted to leave time bombs behind. And what he meant by that was Christian literature that would have its effect later on. And so this work has continued very quietly. Charles Jow just died now in his 90s. I think his memorial service is today. So it went on year after year very quietly, but an enormous amount of literature translated. Some of you know about, I heard talk, Lorraine Bettner, who was really the popularizer of B.B. Warfield's writings, made them understandable with vocabulary that all of us could understand. He made his books available for translation, so the Reformed Doctrine of Predestination and Studies in Theology, works by Bovink, Westminster Standards, and there's a very long list of works that have been translated. And now, in the underground church movement in China that we have contact with, and John McFarland's here, he probably wants me to say in the Far East somewhere, the literature left by the Reformation Translation Fellowship has a powerful impact. So remember, we talked about the printing press and the circulation of Luther's writings, and today distribution of literature is working in the Far East. 1950 marked the end of mission work in China because the communists had taken over and forced out the missionaries. I didn't say a lot last night about the mission in China, but really the scope of the work is utterly amazing. They had schools, they had hospitals, they had orphanages, and it was a very extensive work, and had churches and a presbytery in China, with Chinese ministers and elders, and the Lord really blessed that. It came to the end in 1950, but the church has grown in an underground form there more rapidly than through all the history of foreign missions in that land. Well, missionaries were still missionaries, and so they moved over to Kobe, Japan, and thus our work there began, and a work that continues with four congregations and four Japanese pastors, very small congregations, as most Christian churches in Japan, as is true of most Christian churches in Japan, but a really vital church there. And the result of long, patient work, and of course, Gene and Ruth Spear spent more than 40 years there as missionaries as well. And then on another note, in 1956, all American missionaries were withdrawn from Syria. It's a historical fact that there was opening for missionary work during the age of colonialism. So that our missionaries in Syria, for example, when they were threatened by the local government, would appeal even to the American government and also to the French government for protection. And there was at least one case in which a warship, I'm not remembering whether it was French or American, was sent into the harbor of Latakia as a kind of show of force to try to protect the missionaries from persecution. In God's providence, the age of colonialism came to an end, and it brought about a significant change in the way in which missions were done. However, there was a large congregation left in Latakia with its own pastor, Pastor Awad, and a large Christian school. So the work there did not come to an end with the departure of American missionaries. Yeah, maybe some of you have comments about that, or Harold grew up in Syria and his family was there, so we have some direct contact with that work. Adiba Awad, the daughter of the pastor, was a classmate of mine at Geneva and went back from Geneva to become principal of that Christian school that was there. Well, then let me talk about some other significant events. In 1962, under the Board of Christian Education, when Ken Smith was the called the secretary of that board, kind of an executive secretary, if you will, a denominational administrator in a way. The church launched what they called a Double in a Decade program. I talked last night about the beginning of a long, slow, gradual decline in membership, starting in 1890 and continuing. And the church was not unconcerned about that. There are continual things in the minutes of synod that express sadness for the decline of the church and think about ways in which to reverse that trend. Before Double in a Decade, there had been in the 1940s, under Remo Robb, a program called the Covenanter Crusade. And its goal was to see the membership of the church doubled. Not much happened in terms of membership, although Remo Robb did organize teams of college-age young people, and that was the beginning of the kind of thing that is now being done by short-term mission teams. That began under Remo Robb in the 1940s. Ken Smith decided there was a theological problem with the Covenanter Crusade in that we cannot control the number of people who are converted to Christ. And therefore, that is really not the right thing to do, to say in a certain period of time, we're going to double our membership. So the goal of the Double in a Decade, and this is Christian Education, was to double enrollment in the Sabbath schools. And Ken thought theologically, that's something that we do have some control over. We couldn't control what happens to people's hearts, but we could work vigorously to see more people coming. And in connection with that, I think I mentioned it earlier, was reorganization of Sabbath school work to bring it more clearly under the authority of the sessions in the congregations, and to have the work done through Christian education committees appointed by the session and answerable to the session. And the goal was not reached, but I believe that the changes were helpful, and there was some progress forward made by that effort. On a different way, I was interested in reading the minutes of that year to see that there was a committee that presented a critique of the Confession of 1967 that was being promoted in the PCUSA. Now, the PCUSA, to that point, was nominally committed to the Westminster Confession, though for a long time, ministers in the Presbyterian Church were not required really to adhere to the doctrines of the Confession. The PCUSA decided to, I think, take a step in the direction of honesty and to say we don't any longer fully believe the Westminster Confession, will make a new confession. And that confession was essentially Bardian or Neo-Orthodox in its theology. And it's of interest to me that our church paid attention to that and issued a substantial critique of that new confession. So we were active beyond ourselves in paying attention to trends that were taking place elsewhere. Then in 1968, something happened here that I think was really pivotal for the church. And so after Joe's question, I'll talk about that.
What year was that critique made?
1962. So it took a while. I mean, it took a number of years. The confession was called the Confession of 1967 because that's when it was finally approved.
Okay, so...
But Presbyterians never do anything quickly. So it took a while. It had been published and sent out to the Presbyterian presbyteries for study by that time. Well, when Synod met in Kansas City in 1968, the meeting was preceded by a gathering of delegates called the Covenanter Conference. We met in, I'm not sure it was still called that when we met, but Wilson Bible College. There was a doctor by the name of Wilson that was quite a famous evangelist, and this college was started by him. It was the location where the synod met. I wasn't at this pre-synod meeting because we were just moving to our home in Gibsonia. And I came to Synod, but I wasn't here. And so for quite a while, I didn't really have a sense of the deep significance of this conference. It came as a response to a petition to Synod, or a paper to Synod, brought by Bruce Wilson and John O. Edgar and another person whose name I don't have with me and I don't remember, but Dr. Wilson was the president of the seminary. John Edgar was a well-respected and conservative member of Synod. And they brought a paper saying, we need a conference to deal with the present crisis in the church. The present crisis in the church. Now, this is the year after the change in political dissent. And at the same time, it was evident that there were a number of other positions of the church that were being questioned. And so they felt the need to meet this directly and therefore organized this conference. They drew up a list. Jim Carson, by the way, was the chairman of this committee. Jim is a great organizer. It's one of his great gifts, and a pretty conservative member of the Synod. But he organized the conference, so they had topics that they were going to deal with, They assigned different topics to different presbyteries. Presbyteries held meetings in which they discussed their particular topic. And then the presbyteries brought reports to this conference. They were discussed in the conference, and then recommendations were made to the synod. So I want to give you some of the recommendations. One is that a study be made of the following: the recommendations of the Review Committee of the Pacific Coast study paper, with special attention to item 9, that a committee be appointed to study the extent of corporate fellowship with other denominations in the area of the sacraments. And then another recommendation, also from Pacific Coast, that Synod appoint a special committee to study the feasibility of granting to sessions broader powers of discretion in admitting to the sacraments individuals of evangelical belief and practice. The position of the church before this was called close communion, in which only those who were communicant members of the Reformed Presbyterian Church were admitted to the Lord's Supper or to baptism. And there was had been for quite a long time a good bit of dissatisfaction with that position. And so this conference led to the appointment of a committee to study that issue. And when the committee reported in the 1970s, as we'll see later, the move was made from close communion to session-controlled communion. Here's another one, in a little different way, that Synod appoint a special committee of Synod to prepare a statement to be added to the Church's testimony against racial discrimination. And then they suggest proof texts that might be a part of such a statement. Now, here you need to think about the time in the 60s, the time of the civil rights movement, in which this was a crucial issue. And the conference thought we ought to make a statement with regard to that. That was referred to the committee to revise the testimony, and I forgot to look and to try to locate. I don't remember clearly whether that was added to the testimony, although I think it was the case. Then there were three recommendations that had to do with the use of alcohol and tobacco. So the question of abstinence from alcohol was a live issue at the time, and there were, after this, numerous committees dealing with that issue. And then that Synod review and revise, if necessary, our statement of the terms of membership, and in so doing, consider the following questions. What is the distinction in the use of the terms fellowship, communion, and membership? I mentioned we had what was called terms of communion. People were sometimes unclear whether that meant ecclesiastical fellowship, ecclesiastical communion, or participation in the Lord's Supper. B, should the terms of membership consist only of broad scriptural principles, or include specific applications of those principles? C, should the statement of the covenant of church membership also be used as the terms of communion? And D, should the covenant of church membership be identical with the requirements for admission to the Lord's Supper? And so that led to the appointment of the committees that dealt with not only close communion, but also the statement of terms of membership. And changes were made, as I will talk about in a moment.
Is there a place online or something to where you can find like some of these documents?
The papers are all in mimeographed form at the seminary library in Pittsburgh. It's in the day before putting things in a locked electronic form. That's the only form in which I've seen them.
There is rparchives.org. There's a lot of, I don't know if it's all, but a lot of the old minutes of Synod have been copied.
Yeah, well, that doesn't help here. That's right. All of the minutes of Synod are available online. But these reports to the conference were not made a part of the minutes of Synod. So probably for a fee you could get a staff member at the library to photocopy what is there, but they're in a notebook of the mimeographed reports that were made to the conference.
Mm-hmm.
John?
None of those points that you read there seem to be on the conservative end of things. You had mentioned the Carson and conservatives. But those points don't seem conservative. They seem to be pressing for change.
That's right.
And in what respect did they feel like these were crises? It's a terrible question, important, but
yeah.
Crisis.
Well, I think there was a sense, I know there was a sense, that increasingly these things were coming under question. So you can appoint a study committee to shore up the existing position or to say, well, we really do need to take a new look at this. And I think this is an important observation. The 70s were a time of great change in our church. Unlike some other bodies, the change did not come simply by saying, well, the people are doing it or want it, and so we will permit it without looking at the issues biblically. And the path that our church took was to appoint committees to study carefully the scriptural issues involved. It got to the point where somebody made the comment, we had a number of committees that had in their title the committee to study in depth the scriptural basis for this or that. And somebody said it implies that we never thought about anything deeply before, and now we're doing it for the first time. But it was, we can't simply say this is our tradition, this is what we've always held. Our baseline always was that the scripture is the only infallible rule of faith in life, and positions of the church may always be tested by the scripture, and that was happening in a particular way during this time. Well, while I'm doing this, I'll come back to the discontinuation of Blue Banner Faith and Life, and I'll do this quickly, the constitutional changes, and then we'll take a break. Not quite related to the sort of thing that was in the Covenanter Conference, but out of the interest, Bob Milliken was the man who brought the paper to Synod, was a minister in our church at that time. Interest in the office of deacon as involving basically and fundamentally the ministry of mercy. I talked about this when we were describing the first book of discipline in Scotland. And the Reformation position was deacons are not primarily, they may be this as a kind of subordinate role. Their task is not primarily financial management, but ministry to the poor. In the Westminster form of Presbyterial church government, for example, it says that plainly. The work of deacons is care of the poor. And so there was a committee appointed and came in with a report that gave new emphasis to the ministry of mercy as the work of deacons. And that was put into the Book of Church Government. I think to some extent there's been a new attention given to that, though not, I think there's still a wide field for development of the ministry of the church in terms of ministry of mercy led by deacons. 1977, the terms of membership and communion were revised. And what happened was, in the fourth term of communion, it was changed, instead of, or the fourth query of the covenant of church membership, I should say, it was changed to have people promise that they will submit themselves to the teaching and government of the church. And in the context of the discussion, that meant that instead of a full endorsement of the doctrinal position of the church, that new members would be teachable, would be willing to be taught, would seek to learn, with the hope that they would come then to a full commitment to the position of the church. And there was, in this time period, something that impressed me as to what lay behind this, and that was that at a pre-synodic conference, Bob McCracken, who at that time was a church planter in Marion, Iowa, gave a talk, gave a paper about requirements for church membership, and he talked about his experience with new people. You could think about, some of you would know, Butch Shoup, who's now an elder in Columbus, Indiana. Butch was saved out of the world without any background at all of knowledge in the Bible and so on. Bob was dealing with people like that. And he said, our present requirement means that before people can be admitted to the means of grace, they have to grow to the extent that they embrace the full doctrine of the confession of faith before they can be baptized and admitted to the Lord's table. And so out of the experience of dealing with new Christians and not raised in the church, Bob made a plea that we not require people to be mature theologically before they can be admitted to membership. And I think that carried a lot of weight because Bob is known as one of the more conservative members of the Synod. He was not a radical. He was not trying to push the envelope. And not only his experience, but the question was raised. And we were challenged by groups like the OPC. What is the biblical requirement for people becoming part of the church? And so that was in the background of this change as well. Along with that came at the same time the change from close communion to session-controlled communion. And the two were linked together because the Synod had come to the conclusion that terms of admission to membership and terms of admission to the Lord's Supper should be the same. And there were, interestingly, older ministers in the church. I was a young guy at the time who wanted to change close communion but keep the covenant of church membership the same. But the consensus of the session was that the sacraments are for the church. Terms of admission to the church ought to be the terms of admission to the sacraments. But we changed the requirement for membership to the church so that people who were, members of another church but temporarily worshiping in one of our congregations, they were putting themselves under the teaching of the church where they were worshiping. In that sense, they were submitting to the teaching and government of the church, and therefore they could be admitted to the Lord's Supper. There was a study of covenanting. A paper came questioning our practice of covenanting. And in response to that, in 1979, the ordination query was changed. And I think the essential change was this, that before this, we had talked about the perpetual obligation of covenants. That covenants are binding not only on those who make them initially, but upon all succeeding generations. And the change with biblical study about covenanting in the Bible and so on really removed that aspect of covenanting. The present query says that each generation needs to address the evils and errors of its day and testify against them, and that's really the essence of covenanting. The testimony then was revised. This was a long work by a large committee. Jim Carson was the chairman of the committee that did the revision. And as I've said, now the testimony of the RP Church becomes more clearly a supplement to the confession of faith. The confession of faith is moved into the central position as the statement of the church's doctrine. And then the testimony supplements in three ways, at a few points, not many, but at a few points, to revise the position of the Westminster Confession. One of those, a rather controversial one, but one made by American Presbyterian churches, is to remove the prohibition in the chapter on marriage of marriage to a deceased wife's sister. Now, that would also apply a deceased husband's brother and so on. The technical language in the confession is degrees of affinity and consanguinity. But it was... that was a prohibited marriage historically. It was in the canon law, by the way, of the Church of England that permitted that kind of thing. Henry VIII had to get a indulgence from the Pope in order to marry Catherine of Aragon because she had previously been married to his brother. So it was, had a long history in canon law. And the church in this period of time, well, when I was in seminary, actually, the church in the 1950s, the church changed that. So in the testimony, there is a statement of disagreement with what is in the Westminster Confession. And then also on the civil magistrate, especially the power of the civil magistrate to call assemblies in our testimony, we disagree with the Westminster Confession. Another purpose was to clarify the language of the confession, to make it more understandable, simpler terms and more modern terms than the 17th century English of the Westminster Confession, and then to address additional issues, things that had become matters of controversy or importance since. So there are sections, for example, on education, briefly on economics. There are clear statements about homosexuality and abortion. In the 17th century, no one in the Christian world was advocating a practice of abortion or open homosexuality. They'd become issues, so statements about those are included now in the testimony. So we have the testimony of the church as a supplement now, more clearly, to the Westminster Confession of Faith. And then, without involving deep issues, a revision of the Directory for Government, there had been problems in implementation in a lot of areas, and so a new form of that. The most significant thing about it was that it embodied what's called the two office view of church government instead of a three office view, which has characterized the most Presbyterian churches. Pastor as a distinct office, ruling elder as a distinct office, deacon as a distinct office. Now the present position of the church is that there is one office of elder with two functions, teaching elders and ruling elders. And the effect of that, I believe, has been primarily to elevate the significance of the office of ruling elder. In the old days, elders were not really expected to do shepherding work. And that was left to the pastor. They were to meet in session. They would be expected to lead prayer in prayer meeting, but not expected to do the care, the pastoral care of people. Now I think because of the two office view, we see the importance of a team of elders that are giving the oversight and shepherding the congregation. Practically speaking, we have a 2.5 office view because ministers still have many things that are distinctive about how they actually function in relation to ruling elders. Yeah.
That when the teaching elder became members of the congregation?
That was one of the implications of that, yes. That's a significant thing, that the pastor also is accountable to those who know best how he's living. You know, if you think about pastors only being under the oversight of presbytery, they meet with the presbytery twice a year. The presbytery doesn't know week by week how things are going in the life of the pastor. So his ministry is still under the supervision of the presbytery, but in terms of his own personal life, he's a part of the congregation. And I personally welcomed that when that took place, that I was not somehow above the congregation, but a part of it and a member of the body. But that was related to this change. Yeah.
You spoke about the office of deacon earlier. When did the church adopt the position of deaconess?
In the 1870s. Okay, it's early on. And by the way, it was reviewed recently by Synod in a very, when we met up at Park College. And a majority of Synod approved the continuation of women deacons after a careful exegetical study. So remains the position of the church, but there's a good bit of disagreement with that within, at least in the ministry of the church. Here's a sidelight you might be interested in. B.B. Warfield, in the professor of Princeton Seminary and great champion of orthodoxy, wrote two articles in support of women deacons. And in one of those articles cites a paper by a covenanter minister giving the basis for that. So Warfield at least did not think the covenanters were badly off base in our ordination of women as deacons.
And practically, I've sat in on a number of presbytery meetings where we have fraternal delegates who come and discussing matters of how is it that the church can be unified.
Yeah.
And that's an ongoing, that's an angst that I think we
right.
continue to hear. Well, one of the reasons that we really couldn't be together is
yeah.
because of your position on
right.
on deacons. And so this tends to be a matter that gets discussed a lot among ministers.
Right.
The exegesis is very interesting.
Yeah. Okay. 1998 revision of ordination number, vow number 8, was changed to take out the requirement of abstinence. At the end of a 30-year a very strong debate in the Synod about this. And for a number of years, two-thirds of the Synod decided that the position ought to be changed, but it was vetoed by the vote of the sessions of the Church. And so we had the uncomfortable position that the Synod itself had declared that there was not adequate biblical support for this position, but it remained the law of the Church. And ultimately, it was remembered that the addition of that clause to the ordination vow had happened in 1938 without it being sent down in overture. So what was done was that Synod sent both forms of the vow down in overture. The one requiring abstinence, the one not requiring abstinence. And the result in the vote of the sessions was to approve the form of the vow that did not have the promise of abstinence. And this was real heavy lifting to deal with this issue, given the background in the Church and, in my own view, given the continuing terrific problems that we have with abuse of alcohol in our culture. So a significant change was taken in the revision of the testimony, in which the statement about abstinence was changed to say that abstinence is altogether wise and prudent. It's wise and prudent. But that was intentional language which differed from the requirement of abstinence. So there is a recommendation of abstinence, but not the requirement of it. And so that was an enormous change. Revision of the Book of Discipline to give more prominence to informal efforts to deal with sin before coming to formal trial. And then just last year, a new directory for worship approved, does not make, in my view, substantive changes in what we are doing in worship. The older directory for worship described the form of congregational life which no longer is widely practiced. For example, has in it the carrying on of an every member canvas, a yearly pledge for giving to the Church, and so on. That used to be done. It's not widely done now in our congregations. But the substance of the way in which we worship really has been reaffirmed by the new directory for worship. Joe.
Wasn't that this past year, 2010?
Sorry?
The new directory for worship, wasn't that 2010?
It was passed by Synod in 2009.
It was approved to be sent in overture in 2009. And you're right that it was reported that the overture passed in 2010. Okay, I think that's a good place for us to take a break. Passed over what I had in the notes about the discontinuation of Blue Banner Faith in Life. When he came back to this country from the mission field, Dr. Voss, as a pastor in Hebron congregation, launched a quarterly publication called Blue Banner Faith in Life, which I think had an enormous impact on the Church. It was in a user-friendly form. There would be, if you may know, the publication of the commentary on the larger catechism that's recently been put out. You'll know the format. It's in a form that would lead to discussion in small groups. It was regularly used in adult Sabbath schools or in evening teaching fellowships, and had quite a powerful impact over time on the church, I believe. And I wanted to give you a sampling of the sort of farewell letter that Dr. Voss wrote in the last issue, 1979. It begins by saying, "I am now lying in a hospital bed in Beaver Falls with a broken hip." And he recognized that his time of active ministry was over. And then this paragraph: "When I returned from missionary service in the Far East in 1941, I found the Reformed Presbyterian Church of North America at a low level of awareness of true biblical Christianity. The leadership, in some cases, regarded the historic faith of the church as an outmoded and unimportant thing." Now, notice he says the leadership, in some cases. He's not talking about the whole church. "Actual faith seemed to be in social reform, with our line of honorable history going back even beyond the martyr days of the Second Reformation in Scotland. It seemed a great pity to take our cue from people who did not really believe in redemption through the blood of Christ, but in the reformation of society through various projects. The church seemed confused, frustrated, and unable to go ahead with a constructive program of any kind. After conferring with a good many men and considering and praying about it a good many times, I decided there needed to be a very vocal but simple publication to set forth the true faith of the church." And that's his analysis of the church as he found it in 1941. I think myself it's more harshly critical than it needed to have been. But Dr. Voss was not reticent to express his views. And when he came into the church, he provoked pretty strong reaction. And I think that colored in some ways his view about the leadership of the church. You would have thought he might have been named as a professor at the seminary, given his background, but there was a good bit of feeling against him in the church as a whole. So he felt that, I think. But there is certainly an element of truth, and I tried to illustrate that last night in what he had to say. He talks about some of the mechanics of the publication, and I was interested to know that the printing, he says, was taken up after an initial arrangement by the Reverend David Patterson, so Ron's dad, and later by Mr. Joel Belts of the Reformed Presbyterian Church Evangelical Synod. Now, that's the guy that's he's semi-retired now, but the head of World Magazine. Joel Belts from Iowa.
I went through the World Journalism Institute in 2000, and they took us on a tour in one of their factory building, and we saw one of the mimeograph machines that, and he made reference that there was an old Covenanter magazine that was composed on this machine.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, well...
Yep. Blue Banner Faith and Life. At the end, he says... "I want at this point to express my thanks to God for his faithfulness. He has used me and my not too modern equipment and not too great ability in bearing witness to the Reformed faith. And I think that there has been a rebirth of the true confession of the Covenanter Church, as in many others. And it is my sense that the church is more strongly committed to the Westminster Confession now than it was when I began my ministry 50 years ago. And so I think that's been, in my view, a very positive development in the church. When around us there is all kinds of departure from historic Christianity. In my youth and early days of ministry, Christian Reformed Church was kind of a model to me of what a Reformed Church ought to be. And it's in great danger now of simply becoming a part of the whole modern drift away from solid doctrine. And in God's grace, He's kept us committed to the truth. And I think Blue Banner Faith and Life was a strong instrument to bring that about. On page 16, Psalters and Psalmody. You'll be conscious of this, especially 73, publication of a new book of Psalms for singing. That was my third Psalter, the old green Psalter, the blue Psalter of 1950, green Psalter, I think, 1929, red Psalter of 1973, now blue Psalter. Again, 2009. A couple of times there's been a serious challenge to our practice of exclusive psalmody in the 1970s. There was a paper brought to Synod questioning psalmody. The response to that was the holding of a conference in which a good many papers were presented. And it was published under the title of The Biblical Doctrine of Worship. And so the church reaffirmed its practice of psalmody. Again, a paper came in the 2000s, and there were two responses to that. In 2003, an extensive paper entitled The Worship of the Church, A Reformed Theology of Worship. That's available on the denominational website. And then, more specifically, the next year, a paper entitled The Psalms in the Worship of the Church, which was a reaffirmation of exclusive psalmody. And so that remains a strong commitment of the church, even though it has been questioned in papers to Synod a couple of times in recent years. The organizational development that I want particularly to mention is that we tried to get Synod to work more efficiently, and there were a couple of committees appointed to do that, and to help the Synod establish priorities. When you set the annual Synod's budget, the question always is, on what basis do you allocate the contributions to the church to the different works? And in 1991, a committee reported, and its report was adopted, which gave priority to the health, growth, and multiplication of congregations. And that was a very significant move, and it enhanced the effort in the church to plant new congregations. And I'll comment in a few minutes on the statistical fruit of that kind of movement. There's also the appointment of what's called a Business of Synod Committee, which functions to help the meetings of Synod proceed in a more efficient way, and I think that's been helpful. The seminary has undergone a very significant development during this period of time. For 40 years, R.J.G. McKnight was the president of the seminary and sometimes the only full-time professor. He was a very colorful and effective preacher and teacher. He was, incidentally, a personal friend of Harry Houdini. We have in the seminary library a set of the Jewish encyclopedia that has Houdini's name on the spine. It was Houdini's own personal set of the Jewish encyclopedia. And that came about because Dr. McKnight had a famous lecture on the Witch of Endor, in which he advocated the position, which I don't agree with, that Samuel didn't really appear. And Houdini was interested in exposing the frauds of spiritualists who would hold seances and so on. And so on occasion he would have R.J.G. McKnight come to one of his performances and give his lecture on The Witch of Endor. So in gratitude, Houdini gave this set of the Jewish Encyclopedia to the seminary. But the seminary didn't function in a very organized way, didn't give grades, didn't keep transcripts. It was pretty much a tutorial kind of situation. And so in 1954, Bruce Wilson was elected president to succeed Dr. McKnight, and Bruce Wilson began a long, patient effort to bring the seminary into a position of more academic respectability, and labored at that for 19 years, which culminated in 1973 with the seminary being authorized to award the MDiv degree. Now, in some states, school can easily grant master's and doctor's degrees. They're called degree mill states. California, Ohio, Florida. You can see advertisements, get your PhD by mail. But Pennsylvania is quite rigorous, and so we had to meet pretty strict requirements to be able to grant the degree. And that led then the Synod, at the request of the Seminary Board, to finance graduate study for professors so that we could have professors with degrees. Clark Copeland was unable to get his doctor's degree at Concordia Seminary in St. Louis. Bruce Wilson himself did graduate work at Indiana University for a year. I was sent at the full support of the seminary to do doctoral work and get a degree. Duncan Lowe later on. And that was all a part of this effort to upgrade the seminary academically. And the result was the authority to grant degrees, and this greatly expanded the ministry of the seminary. Before that, it was almost exclusively for men from our own church. So when I was a student there, there were perhaps 12 students. All but one or two were RPs. But when we got the ability to grant degrees, then the quality of the seminary's work was validated for other churches. And so we began to get more and more students from other groups, not least from black Baptist students in the city of Pittsburgh. At about the same time this was happening, Pittsburgh Seminary, which under Addison Leach and John Gerstner had been an evangelical seminary, turned liberal. And so these evangelical black pastors would go there, and they found out that that seminary did not believe what they believed about the Bible and about the gospel, and so they began to learn about our seminary. And so there came to be quite an expansion of our student body, so that now we have well over 100 students, and they're not all full-time students, but about more than 40 full-time equivalent students. And the significance of that is the expansion of the effect of the teaching of the seminary far beyond our own bounds. And so that's been an enormous development. It continued then under Bruce Stewart, who again worked patiently for a long time, until in 93 we were accredited by the American Theological Society. That's similar to Middle States accreditation of a college. And again, validated the seminary and made it more attractive to people from other groups. We've added an MTS, Master of Theological Studies degree, which involves 2 years instead of three, and is open to women, the MDiv program, because we don't believe that women ought to be preachers. The MDiv is not open to women, but the MTS is. And we have a significant number of women students. And then just recently, approval of a DMIN program, and at the same time development of a biblical counseling center and program that involved purchase of a building across Penn Avenue from the seminary, which has been remodeled for a counseling center and a place to store library books that have outgrown our capacity in the building. So I think that the Lord has really blessed the seminary, and it's been one of the means by which the church has really extended its influence a great deal. Well, I give a table there, which may be discouraging to you as you look at it. At 20-year intervals, look at the members column. Almost 10,000 in 1875. From there, there was a spike in between then and 95 before the departure of people in 1891. But a long, slow, steady decline until 1995. And then in the last 10 years, a small reversal of that, and nevertheless significant. I thought that oftentimes in our history we have been a proud church, proud of our heritage, proud of our faithfulness. I believe that at least in this area the Lord has humbled us. And we have recognized that we need His blessing and seek His blessing. I want to call your attention to the number of missionaries in 1915, 47, that rose to 50 in 1920. And for a small church of less than 9,000 members, to have 50 missionaries was really striking. A number of those would be short-term missionaries who served in the schools, especially in Cyprus. But there was really a hearty support of foreign mission work. And the 2005 number of three missionaries doesn't take in now the Cush for Christ team, which has been added since that time. So there's been a small growth, but compared to what we were doing in 1920, the foreign mission work of the church is much reduced. And it leads to reflection on why do we not have the same support for missions that we had in the previous century. Let me do some, on the next page, some analysis of statistics. And statistics is a very technical field, so this is very much an amateur effort. But I have found these things quite interesting. In 1960, there were 70 congregations listed in the minutes of Synod. Bringing it up to 2006, during that 46-year period of time, 10 older congregations grew, 10 out of 70, meaning the other 60 either were static or declined in their membership. Those who grew at an average rate of a half a member per year. So you think about a growth of 23 members in 46 years. 25 or 26, it gets a little tricky because sometimes they unite, a rural congregation would unite with a town congregation like Morning Sun and Sharon. So it's a little hard to say whether it simply disappeared. But given a little bit of leeway there, 25 or 26 of the 70 were disorganized. That's a big proportion out of 70. Not quite one-third of the existing congregations disorganized. And 34 or 35 of them lost members. So think what would have been the case if that trend had continued in that 60-year period, in that, 46-year period. Well, in 1990, there were 75 congregations and mission stations, and 23 of those, or nearly one-third of the congregations, were new. They had not existed in 1960, which is the year that I was ordained. One-third of the membership then of the church was in new congregations. Not only the survival, but the small growth of the church took place primarily in new church plants since 1960. In 1960, three out of about 60 pastors were from non-RP backgrounds. All the others had grown up in the RP church. The three ministers in 1960, the three pastors were J.G. Voss, F.F. Reed, who was in Boston, and Frank Fraser, who was in Portland, Oregon. All the other pastors of the church. This doesn't include professors at Geneva or at the seminary. These are active pastors. In 1998, 38 out of 63 pastors were from non-RP backgrounds. In 2006, 54 out of 76 from non-RP backgrounds. More than 70% of the pastors not having grown up in the church. That's an enormous change. And when I count those who grew up in RP backgrounds, I'm including guys like Brad, whose dad did not grow up in the RP church. So we're coming now to the second generation, Dave Hansen, other folks like that. Given the long history of the church and its largely traditional character. It's Scotch-Irish ethnicity. This is an enormous change, and it took place gradually over a long period of time. But it is amazing to me that the church held together through this. It's easy to check the pastors. That's what I've done. In our congregation at Grace, I would say two-thirds of our members did not grow up in RP churches. About the same proportion would be true of North Hills. And it's a little harder to check that, but I think it might be a slightly smaller percentage in the membership of the church, but there's also been that kind of change. One of the ways that I try to say it in a colorful way is that we now have more pastors whose names end in a vowel than we have whose names begin with an MC. And so we got Olivetti and Bakenstow and so on, ethnic names that are not Scotch-Irish. And what are the factors in that? Well, I think the Lord has maintained our soundness in the gospel, and that has been attractive to those who come from other backgrounds. And another thing connected with this is that I believe it's involved this kind of cross-pollinization in the church. In biology or genetics, they talk about hybrid vigor. And I think there's something to that, in that we have people that have come in with fresh viewpoints, different kinds of experiences, other ways of doing things, and I believe that that has enriched the church. It's really significant that this change has taken place at the same time that there has been the strengthening of commitment to the Reformed faith and to the Westminster Confession, and a maintenance of a strong commitment to psalmody. And you might expect with all kinds of new people, we'd have much more radical changes. It's a fact that the changes that took place in the 70s were initiated largely by people who grew up in the church, not by people who came in from outside the church. So it's been quite an interesting and, to me, amazing thing to watch, but a matter of hopefulness for the future growth and development of the church. I want to discuss for a little bit the factors in new or growing congregations. And I enter into an area now that's risky because be talking about people that you know about and so forth, and maybe differences of opinions. I'm thinking here particularly, not exclusively, but particularly about Great Lakes Gulf Presbytery and St. Lawrence Presbytery, because those have been the two presbyteries in which there has been the most church planting, and in that sense, the greatest growth in the church. So I'm looking at those, not exclusively. I'm aware of developments here, a number of new congregations, especially in Colorado, but not only there. But those two presbyteries particularly, and what factors are there? Well, one factor has been long-term effective leadership. Think about Great Lakes Gulf. Roy Blackwood went to Indianapolis when there was no church, I believe 1973, thereabouts. Remained there then for the next 30 years. This is what I mean by long term. Went there with a vision derived partly, I think, from his study of Symington, also by contact with the navigators, with ideas of discipleship and evangelism and the small group activities, Bible studies and so on, and with the navigator's principle of multiplication, that is, each one training and teaching somebody else to come alongside and grow in Christian life and ministry. And so from Second RP, it's called that because historically there had been earlier on an RP church in Indianapolis that failed. From Indianapolis came, not in this order necessarily, Columbus, Indiana, Lafayette, and then those congregations themselves planted daughter congregations, especially Lafayette. You had Kokomo and so on. So there was a multiplication, and Roy Blackwood was the instrument used by God to encourage keep saying, as Roy often does, Christ promised he would build his church, and we need to believe his promise, and then to act on the basis of that. In St. Lawrence, it was Ed Robeson at Syracuse who went to a dying congregation with just a handful of people and saw the Lord bless that congregation, and then from there, Oswego and Ottawa, and then Ottawa planted other daughter congregations, and Oswego planted Fulton, and so on. So there was again this multiplication with a man used by God at the center of each for long-term effective leadership. And then what I call scripture-based optimism. An expectation that, in fact, Christ would build his church if we sought to be faithful in reaching out. And not saying, I hope, maybe someday, 10 years down the road, something will happen, but expecting the Lord to bless and praying in that way. And then what I call opportunism. My tendency would be myself to go very slow on any kind of new endeavor. But I think in these places and in others, here's a group of people in another town that may be interested in a Bible study. Let's go start a Bible study. Here's an opportunity. Let's not appoint a committee to study it for 3 years. Let's move to do something. And so that was how they operated. And then discipleship and multiplication. That which you have received from me among many witnesses, commit to. That which you have learned of me among many witnesses, commit to faithful men who will teach others also. That's 2 Timothy 2:2, the principle of multiplication. And then discipleship in the terms of pastors often, but also others, taking younger Christians under their wing and helping them move along in the Christian life. So you may have your own experience of this kind of thing, but as I've tried to reflect on factors that have led to growth, I think that these have operated. I'm not going to take time to go through the list of denominational leaders. Again, this is risky. Who did I leave out that ought to be mentioned? But at the seminary, I teach this course to people who don't know the people of the church, and it's been a way of trying to give them some sense of those who have been prominent in the life of the church. And let me conclude by talking for a little bit about three streams of influence on the present church. And all three of these I regard in a predominantly positive way. The church, in a sense, is a rope of three strands that have all contributed, I think, to make the church what it is today. And the first is what I call the covenanter heritage. A sense of history, I've tried to go over that and what we've done together here. The recounting of what happened in Scotland, the telling of the martyr stories, the practice of the kind of the form of Christian life that goes back through the generations, things like family worship, memorizing the shorter catechism, careful observance of the Sabbath, knowing people, and this can be a bad thing, talking about who is related to whom. But that's a part of the covenanter heritage, and we've done a fair amount of it here in thinking about the past. So that's a factor that has made the church what it is. Then the Reformed faith. Here I'm thinking about the doctrines of the Reformation and of Calvinism embraced beyond us by other similar churches. I'm thinking about the NAPARC churches, Orthodox Presbyterian, PCA, ARP increasingly, although it has recently been kind of rescued from a drift into more liberal theology, but is, I think, coming back from that. And this is what Dr. Voss, I think, strongly advocated in the Blue Banner Faith and Life, calling us back to the confession and to the catechisms strongly and without apology, defending the doctrines of Calvinism. And I connect a couple of other people with the revival of this. And not to embarrass anyone here, but I'm thinking of Sam Boyle and others who on the mission field had contact. Sam was very strongly in the Covenanter Heritage part of this as well, but on the mission field had contact with Orthodox Presbyterians, conservative Presbyterians, often from the Southern Church, Christian Reformed ministers, and in that way got an interest in and knowledge of Reformed literature more broadly. RTF involved in publishing that kind of literature. I think of Bruce Wilson at the seminary, who in earlier times, especially in Bloomington, when he was pastor there, had contact with people like Carl Henry, who was a leader of the evangelical movement in the country and editor of Christianity Today. There was a Christian Reformed philosophy professor at Indiana, Harry Jellema, who regularly worshipped in the Bloomington Church, and Monday morning, Bruce Wilson would always go over and have breakfast with him, and they would talk about the sermon, and he brought that Christian Reformed perspective on things, and then Bruce Wilson brought that to the seminary. And so the Reformed faith as a, I think, a very strong factor now in the life and belief and preaching of the church. And then influence from evangelical movements. And not necessarily Reformed, but I mentioned in the 19th century a group called Christian Endeavor, that promoted particularly young people's work, and that group had an influence in our church and in the development of specific young people's activities. And we talked about the Forward Movement in the 1920s. That was a broad evangelical movement that had a significant impact on our church, and I think, for generally speaking, for the good. And then more recently, in my time, the Navigators, a group that originated in the military service, Dawson Trotman was in the Navy, and developed the principles that the Navigators have developed. They became the people in charge of follow-up for Billy Graham crusades. Billy Graham was concerned that many who came forward in his crusades did not continue on in the Christian life, and so he was concerned to organize discipleship for such people and ask the Navigators to be in charge of that. Before and during the time that I was in seminary, there was a Navigator representative who was in Pittsburgh. He actually lived in the parsonage of Central Pittsburgh Church before Ken Smith was married. And so the parsonage was a big house, and he had Leroy Imes and his wife Virginia live there with their children. Later, Ken married a Navigator representative by the name of Floy Moody. She had been one who lived in the house with Dawson Trotman, the founder of the Navigators. And when people like Paul McCracken and Bob McFarland and Bob McCracken and that group of people were in seminary, Leroy Imes worked with them. They went to fraternity houses of the universities in Pittsburgh to share the gospel and to work with people. And I've said, this is probably fading something somewhat now, but that in most places, most congregations where there was evangelistic activity and fruitfulness, there probably was some contact with the navigators. And so I'm thinking of men of the generation of Ken Smith, Roy Blackwood, Paul McCracken, Bob McCracken, Armour and Bob McFarland, Ray Joseph, people of that generation, strongly impacted by the navigators. And one of the things that it did in my own life was to really emphasize the importance of personal Bible study. That was a big emphasis. And navigators had the problems of a parachurch organization. But I think the men who were influenced by them have turned out to be strong churchmen, and so brought the strength of the navigators into the life and the work of a Reformed church. Now you get sometimes people that may be strongly in one of these three strands that are highly critical of the other strands, and that's probably fair enough. But as I look at the church, I believe that the Lord has used all three of these lines of influence to build a church that is strongly proclaiming the gospel, is characterized by biblical preaching, and known also by warm fellowship, which is welcoming to new people who come. And the Lord has built that into us in spite of our weaknesses and failings and foibles. And so I think we can look with some hopefulness to what He will continue to do with us. So let me stop with that and give you opportunity for questions or comments. Bill.
I'm curious what your impressions are on that table. As I look at you pastors sharing the responsibility with elders, a pastor in 1875 that had twice as many members to care for. Even in the situation currently, it seems that pastors feel rather overwhelmed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I look at the double the amount of people that they had to care for and how they were able to achieve that. Did they have some loss in terms of what they could do that affected the vitality of the church, or was it the sense that we have a lot more other responsibilities since we're so global in areas?
That's a really good question. And it's hard to generalize, so I could only give impressions. I do think in the earlier time, what was expected of a pastor was pretty clearly defined. We were a very homogeneous group, and so there would be the regular preparation for the Lord's Day. But it would be expected in those days that afternoons primarily would be used for pastoral visitation. And that general practice has dropped out of our congregational life. Probably evenings as well, but as I think about descriptions from that time, often afternoons. And pastors worked very hard at getting around to all the homes of the congregation. So I think administrative responsibilities take more of a pastor's time these days. Probably more of crisis counseling than was the case then. And the care may not have been in the same depth that I think we aim for at the present time. But I can remember Mary's dad, as we began to develop the pattern of young men out of seminary going and serving as interns or assistants for a while, not feeling they were ready to be a pastor, Dad would say, "Well, when we got out of seminary, we never thought of that. We were ready to go to work." And so I don't know what all the factors are in that, but that's... Whatever may be the case with that, I think it does make the training of elders for sharing that load really important.
I didn't really realize this growing up, but looking back, I had a very wonderful perspective on the work God was doing in Indiana. I was born in 1977, was baptized by Dr. Roy Blackwood. He also performed my wedding. And so I bear witness to the blessing of that long-term leadership you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
There was an article I ran across just recently, published in Reformation 21, entitled Discipleship and Planting Churches, written by William Van Dudewaard, who I think is an associate professor now at Puritan Reformed Seminary. And he interned under Barry York, which is a granddaughter church of the church in Indianapolis. I thought it was probably the best summary that I've, you know, article-length summary that I've seen to date on how did churches multiply, and written from a very definitely theological perspective, but came out of an interview that Van Dudewaard did with Barry York at Puritan Reformed Seminary. And I just found it very, it put into words things that I had seen and observed as a little kid. So that was encouraging to me.
I'd like
to hear a few minutes from you on the NAE and its influence on us and ours on it across.
Okay. Yeah, on the list of people, I mentioned Howard Elliott was pastor and clerk of synod and secretary of the NAE. NAE is the National Association of Evangelicals. And this was another area in which the side of our church that sought fellowship and opportunities to work with other groups showed itself. So National Association of Evangelicals was formed, I believe, in the 1940s as an organization to draw together people who identified themselves as evangelicals. Not to get on too much of a bypath. In the 1920s, there was what was called the modernist fundamentalist controversy. And all Orthodox people at that point were called fundamentalists. Machen would call himself a fundamentalist. Group of Christians and churches that held to the Orthodox doctrines of the faith, like the inspiration of the Bible and the virgin birth and the miracles and the substitutionary atonement and the bodily resurrection of Christ, came to a point in the 1930s where there was a diversion on the one hand between those who continued to be called fundamentalists, who thought the trouble in the church came from seminaries and from academic activity and so on. And so they went the route of having Bible colleges that weren't interested particularly in scholarship, but in practical training of people for ministry. They tended to be congregational and Baptistic and premillennial in their theology. And then there were the evangelicals who said, we need to meet the errors of our day with scholarly study, so we need seminaries, but we need sound seminaries. And so that was the evangelical movement, and the National Association of Evangelicals was an effort to have them work together. And early on, our church became a part of the Association of Evangelicals. Getting a lot of grief for doing that because we were associating with Arminians and Pentecostals in that broad association. More recently, a number of the other conservative Reformed churches have joined the NAE, and now most of us have pulled out because the NAE itself has been taken over by kind of left-wing evangelicals that are into environmentalism and other movements like that. But anyway, for a good bit of the latter part of the 20th century, we were part of the NAE. Howard Elliott, with his great efficiency in getting things done, became the secretary of, and a part of the board of directors of the NAE. And later, Jack White, president of Geneva College, was for 1 year the president of the NAE. So it was an effort to work with others, even though they weren't fully Reformed, but were real Christians. And by way of people like Howard Elliott and Jack White, I think we had a significant impact on the NAE. Probably Bruce Stewart ought to be mentioned in that connection as well. So,
question about the seminary. One of the things that I've noticed in Reformed and evangelical seminaries is this tendency toward what they call academic excellence and the tension between traditional systematic theology and critical biblical studies.
Yeah.
To what extent are, say, critical biblical studies a slippery slope? Is that something that our seminary would ever offer?
Uh-huh. Well, I'm thinking now of Fuller Seminary, which was founded as kind of the centerpiece of the evangelical movement. I'm thinking also of Calvin Seminary, which has undergone a very sad decline in recent years. I think there's a great snare in seminary education to want to be on the cutting edge of scholarship, to gain the respect of the broad academic seminary community. And I think it's a real snare, because then the seminaries tend to employ professors who have the gifts to do that kind of work. And being more concerned about cutting-edge theological speculation, if I may, than soundness in the faith. Even Westminster in Philadelphia, they just dismissed a professor who embraced the idea that there is much of myth in the Old Testament and denial of the inerrancy of the Scripture. And so that's a snare. On the other hand, we don't want to be sloppy or naive in our exploration of the truth, and so our seminary has been concerned to get men who were academically trained to do the teaching. But that's we got to be aware of that temptation and not, I think, I'm glad that our seminary doesn't aim to be a cutting-edge academic institution. We want to be a responsible and competent academic institution. Another factor that's involved is how closely the seminary is connected with the life of the church. And Dr. Robert Paul was the chairman of my doctoral committee when he celebrated his 65th birthday. The president of his seminary wrote a kind of laudatory article about him, and including that was he expressed with a kind of amazement, "Would you believe Dr. Paul goes to church every Sunday?" Now think about feeling the necessity to make that comment. Meaning, it's an unusual thing in my experience, this professor is saying, that a seminary professor would go regularly to church. So the temptation has been for academic life in the seminary to be separated from the real life of the church. And so our Peace Seminary has the unwritten but pretty firm rule that every full-time professor must have pastoral experience, and the professors continue to be active in the lives of congregations. But it's a danger to be guarded against, and we got to work hard at it to keep the seminary the servant of the church and closely connected to the church. Other questions or comments? Nancy.
I think we often think about the dangers that are foreign missionaries are supposed to. And there were some dangers in this country, too. My grandfather was a minister in Selma in the late 20s and 30s. And my mother taught in the Knox Academy. They had 500 black students from kindergarten through 12th grade, and they had to frisk those kids as they came in. She was principal of the school there, but she was told by the parents of the children there, if we see you or if you see us on the downtown streets of Selma, do not greet us, because that is for your safety as well as ours. And she said she never realized what loneliness was until they were a white family ministering to the black community.
Yeah.
And neither one of them would have anything to do with the pastor of the family.
Yeah.
And some of the situations where grandfather had to go up into the hills, and they would have grandpa, who had just passed away, would be on the dining room table in the shack.
Yeah.
And I think there was just a lot of things that were going on in this country about that time, too. That there was still a lot of students.
Yeah. Well, that leads me to tell you a story that I heard from Bruce Wilson. Not quite as serious as that, but still makes the point. It was in Evans, Colorado, and I don't know the name of the pastor. But he was a strong temperance man, and the people who were involved in the saloon business in the town didn't like it. So they decided one day to come and interrupt the worship service, and armed men, this is in frontier days, came into the church with the purpose of interfering with the service. And the pastor pulled out his revolver and laid it on the pulpit and said, "Let us engage in the worship of God."
Maybe in that connection too, you probably could comment better than I could, but the connection between the church in Selma and the civil rights movement.
Yeah.
Comment on that. I found that quite.
Well, Claude Brown, the black pastor, was had real status in the town of Selma, but he was caught in between. He knew all of the leaders of the civil rights movement, but he was more moderate, and he could negotiate with the white community during that time, and so as demonstrators would be arrested, Claude Brown had the status that he could go and persuade the authorities to release young people that had been arrested and so on. He was placed in a very strategic role at the time of the Selma to Montgomery march and through that whole time. I remember being impressed as a young man. He came to assist in communion at Walton once, and his description of difficulties, which I hadn't known about, but he said, I remember him saying, it's much harder for us to travel in the north than in the south. In the south, there were facilities for colored. So if they needed to stop for a bathroom stop, they knew where they could go. In the north, they didn't know where they would be permitted to use facilities and where they wouldn't. So I remember as a high school boy having that sense of the civil rights struggle that I got from just, we rode with Claude Brown to look at some of the scenery around Walton, and remember him talking about that kind of thing.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is that at least components of the march from Selma to Montgomery were planned in the parsonage, the RP parsonage there in Selma.
I don't have knowledge of that, but I'm not surprised if that were the case.
And and another just interesting connection, that it was one of the assistants to Martin Luther King in that march that went on to become one of the founders or very much involved in some way in the United Nations. And I was walking through the United Nations facility and saw a picture of that march from Selma to Montgomery. And again, I want to do more research on this, but I think there's a man who's clearly a pastor in that picture, and Dr. King, and then there's this gentleman who went on to be very involved in the United Nations.
Ralph Bunch, do you think? I don't know.
That might be.
I think Ralph Bunch was in Stanford University with Mac Robb, as I recall. So, Joe.
You're obviously talking about something that has some fodder or the march from Selma to Montgomery. I'm sorry, I'm not a good student of history. What was the significance of that?
Well, it was a significant event of the civil rights movement, and it was a kind of public demonstration. And got a lot of headlines. I don't know beyond that. It was just a very well-known and well-publicized public demonstration intended to be peaceful, although I think there was an attack upon the marchers by the authorities. So it was just one of the outstanding events of the whole civil rights movement.
And those pictures became kind of symbolic and iconic, yeah, of the oppression of
folks. Yeah. Nancy.
I just have a different take on that, but Claude Brown was one of his mother's students, and she was very, very pleased. I was so proud at that time. She was very pleased at the way he went on to send her. And just to show the affection that there is among the black, the church there. So we went to visit when I was probably 10, 11 years old. We arrived at noon, and by evening they had a whole program planned, including a dinner and entertainment and everything. And then my brother, who was the pastor in Orlando for 27 years, would go back up there to preach, and he was always Miss Greta's boy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Well, I think it's time for us to stop with that, and Wade maybe has a way to tie us off.